From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Okay, football is huge in America, never bigger than this weekend. Super Bowl time, the extravaganza. My guest today, Susan Rayburn, goes way back in football history to the beaches of Jamestown. The first games after the Civil War, 7-day train rides to play rivals. This hour on point ahead of Super Bowl 48, 400 years of American football. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Despite everything, the injuries, the brain damage, the super hoopla, what is it that brings us back again and again in this country to football, American football? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will turn to sports reporter Armin Katayan for a look ahead to Sunday's Seahawks-Broncos Super Bowl game. But first, joining me from Washington is Susan Rayburn, writer and editor for the Library of Congress, big sports fan, sports historian. She co-authored Baseball Americana with Harry Katz and Frank Cerisi. She's out with a big new book digging way back into the origins of American football. It is titled Football Nation, 400 Years of America's Game. Susan Rayburn, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be here.
I want to get back to those beaches of Jamestown, but just walk us through some names that through your book are associated with American football, and I don't know how. Abigail Adams, what's the connection?
Well, Abigail Adams, you might be able to consider one of the first football widows, actually.
Get out of town.
In 1777, as the American Revolutionary War is raging, she is running the family farm up in Massachusetts and becomes a little perturbed about what she's seeing around her. The militia, which is supposed to be defending the area and preparing as the Redcoats arrive. Some of the militiamen are off playing football. They're playing ninepin. But it's football that she mentions in a letter to her husband, John Adams, who was away with the Continental Congress.
She calls it football. We'll look at what qualifies as football in your book. But that's these boys are supposed to be ready for the Redcoats, and they're playing football. Nathan Hale back in Revolutionary era as well. What's the connection there, Susan?
Absolutely. His friends knew of him as a football enthusiast, actually. He would play in the Bowery in New York, and he even makes a reference in his diary shortly before he's executed by the British, to cleaning his gun, playing checkers, and playing a game of football. So the football that we're seeing back then, of course, doesn't look quite what it looks like today, but people were calling it football. The English term football actually goes back to the Middle Ages.
We'll look at that one. Just a regular Sunday in America, cleaning your gun, playing checkers, and playing football. Confederate General James Longstreet, Civil War era. What's the football connection there?
Football actually was something that the Union armies were encouraging soldiers to play. It was a way for them to let off steam while they're waiting out the time in camp, occupation duty. Even the South recognizes the value also of making footballs available to their troops. And football is being played in prisoner of war camps during the Civil War. That's another activity that's occurring. So the game, it's a very rough and tumble game, not a lot of rules, but that's what they're doing to occupy themselves during the Civil War when they're not on the battlefields.
The rules come in after the Civil War. We'll look at that. It goes to talk about rough and tumble. Early 20th century football really something. And you've got an Al Capone connection here. What's the great mobster have to do with football?
Well, I realized he was a baseball fan, so I figured, you know, there's a good chance he's also a football fan.
What, he ran the betting? So that is that it? Or?
So it turned out, actually, at the Library of Congress in our wonderful prints and photographs division, where we have more than 14 million images, we actually found an image of him at a Northwestern game. He rooted for the Wildcats. And the picture was taken a couple of weeks before he was convicted, actually, of tax evasion and sent off to prison into Alcatraz. But that particular picture that we feature in the book is one of the last games that he's going to see. And fans have turned on him at this point. His career has kind of taken a turn. He's regarded as being responsible for the St. Valentine's Day massacre. So the fans aren't especially thrilled to see him. And he arrives at the stadium with his henchmen. And the president of the University of Chicago asks the head of security, can we please get rid of this guy? You know, I don't want him here at the game.
Yeah.
And the head of security says, well, we can't. He bought a ticket just like everybody else.
Al Capone, legal attendee at the game.
That's right.
And this back in the day when college football was really something. You've got great stories about college football, things I had no idea about. Guys who would play on several teams, kind of travel around almost galley slaves to college football teams, play until they're 40. We've got more names on this list. I want to get to John Lennon, Hirohito. But we want to get to this 400 years of football business. And before I even let you have your swing at it, Susan, football fans engage. And we've got engaged listeners already. Scituate, Massachusetts, Mike is calling. 400 years of American football. What do you say, Mike?
Am I on? Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear. What's on your mind?
Great. I think you're wrong about the 400 years, but you're pretty close. I'm pretty sure the Aztecs used to cut off the heads of their victims and play football with them. Pretty sure about that.
Do they have a halftime, Mike?
You know, I don't know. That might be where they made the guacamole, though.
Make the guacamole. Susan, how do you define it? Football in America, 400 years. Mike takes it back to Aztecs and, you know, decapitation.
You can actually go back much further than that. You can go back to the ancient Greeks. You can go back to the ancient Chinese playing games that are similar to various forms of football. What I'm doing in this book is looking at the English word football in the Americas, in North America. And the earliest references that I can find to using that word, that English word football, takes us back to Jamestown. I have no doubt, you know, about the Aztecs playing some wild games and also serving guacamole. We know that guacamole was around for about 2,000 years.
Okay. So we can't have halftime. Okay.
So what I'm doing in this book is looking at the term football in English in North America, you know.
So Jamestown, 1609, football. What did it mean? What are you talking about? What were they talking about?
Okay, so what the English colonists are seeing when they arrive is a game that is somewhat similar to their game. So they refer to it as football. But they notice that the Indians are playing with a greater level of sportsmanship, for one thing, than they exhibit, which is one of the reasons why early football is also called mob ball in England. And they comment on this. They comment about the fact that the Indians aren't tackling each other. They aren't trying to hurt each other. They aren't trying to break each other's noses, which was apparently the way
the
you
English
operated
way.
In England.
Yeah.
Right. But they're using the term football, and what they're describing are games played in which there are goals on either end. In some cases, it's a kicking game. In other cases, the Indians are throwing the ball or they're able to catch the ball. And the games can take place over a couple of days. And in fact, there's almost kind of a weird connection to first downs in that at the end of the day, they will mark the ball where it was last played, leave it there, come back the next day and pick it up from the same spot.
So the Jamestown settlers come over with an English idea of football. They see a Native American idea of what they call football.
Right.
I'm still trying to get my head around how you think about this. When you say it goes back to the ancient Greeks or the ancient Chinese, what combination of people and, you know, whether it's decapitated heads or a ball of cloth or what, it adds up to something like football in your definition?
Right. Well, the term football applies to a number of sports in America, actually, up until the late 19th century. It's covering any kind of game that in which the ball is being kicked, a game in which you can kick it and catch it, a game in which you can also run with it. So it applies to a number of
so
games.
You've got kind of soccer and rugby and everything in this pot when you go back that far.
Well, you're talking about, yes, a lot of games that are emerging out of that. But rugby and soccer, as we know them today, don't adopt their rules or take those names until the 19th century either. So the word football is being used to apply to a number of games that are being out there that are out there for hundreds of years.
So are you saying it's got a ball, something, it's got a kind of a scrum, and you may be kicking and you may be passing, but they're calling it football. Did that stay around, stay alive in this sort of amorphous, unruled state all the way until after the Civil War when it suddenly got more regulated?
Well, you have in the early 19th century the development of rugby, and so Americans are finding out about it that way, that there are these other options that you can use. And so you have a team called the Oneida Football Club, which is recognized as kind of the first organized American football club. And they're in Boston, actually. They're playing on Boston Common, and they are private high school students. And they're taking combinations of different games. For example, they're looking at rugby. They're looking at soccer. They're looking at all kinds of different games that they like their favorite features, putting it together. And this is called the Boston Game. And this becomes a game that is popular throughout New England. And when those kids get older and go to Harvard, they take with them the Boston Game. Meanwhile, over at Yale, they're playing association football, which we know as soccer. And so the thing that you have then is after the Civil War in the 1870s, you have different colleges playing their own style of football. And the problem is, how do you compete with each other when you all have a different game?
Right,
and that's the issue. Right. That's the issue that they're working out in the 1870s.
We're going to go to that, to how football became a kind of uniform game across this country. Of course, Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday, Super Bowl 48. It's going to be Bruno Mars. Take it back right here for a very different sound. This was Super Bowl VII behind me, 1973, before all of the lights and glam and smoke. Halftime was just singer Andy Williams and the University of Michigan marching band. Here they are with their halftime rendition of People behind us. Susan Rayburn is with us. Her new book is Football Nation, 400 Years of America's Game. I can't get over the sound of this halftime song. That is not 2014 Super Bowl VII. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Is deep, and they're firing downfield. Swan going after covered, and it's juggled. Swan catches another circus catch inside the Dallas 45-yard line. Gets up and goes inside the 40.
Super Bowl X, 1976, and the famous circus catch of Lynn Swan there, Pittsburgh wide receiver. Got 49 passes, 781 yards in that game, the famed circus catch. Pittsburgh won 21-17. We're talking this hour about 400 years of American football, from the beaches of Jamestown to Super Bowl 48 this Sunday. Susan Rayburn is my guest, author of Football Nation, 400 Years of America's Game. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. She is out of the Library of Congress and knows her stuff. This is a beautifully illustrated, kind of amazingly illustrated. Some of the drawings and photographs in here will just blow your mind, all the different ways football has been played in what we now call the USA. Of course, there's a certain kind of spirit that runs through the whole thing. Here's a little recording, 1968, recorded by Green Bay Packer Jerry Kramer. This is coaching legend Vince Lombardi giving this speech to his Packers moments before the start of Super Bowl II against the Oakland Raiders. Big game, but his advice boiled down to the basics. Lombardi.
Talk about coming easy. This is a club that's going to hit you. They're going to try to hit you, and you're going to take it out of them. Just hit, just run, just block, and just tackle. If you do that, there's no question what the answer is going to be in this ball game. Keep your poise. There's nothing that they can show you out there. You have to face a number of times, right?
Off we go. Hit. They're going to hit. You're going to hit. Block, tackle, and go. Vince Lombardi there. Susan Rayburn joins us from Washington. We want to dive in and figure out how this began to become a more regularized game. Susan, we've got questions for you, though. Buffalo, New York. Anita, thanks for calling, Anita. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Well, I'd like to ask your guest, when did the shape of the football change from round to the current day shape that it is? I know in Europe, they are still playing what's called football with a round ball, and it's called soccer.
Yeah, I don't even know what you call the shape of an American football, but when did it take that shape, Susan?
Well, it depended on the school, but Harvard adopts it after playing against McGill University, which is a Canadian school, in 1875. One of the things they discover is that this round ball they've been carrying around really isn't ergonomically shaped. And so they adopt the idea of sort of the oblate, oblong ball shortly after they play in 1875. And other teams start to realize as football progresses that this is the easier way to carry the ball.
So football starts really in its more regularized form in the northeast of the United States. You've got Walter Camp in there. How does it come together and turn into a regularized game?
You're right. The game, as we have come to know it, as we recognize it, does develop in the Northeast, in the colleges. That's where the game flourishes at first, and then it begins to spread to the rest of the United States through public schools, where it's the private schools in the Northeast where it begins.
Yep.
And so what you've got are these schools that are negotiating with each other on how can we have meaningful
competition.
We'd
like to play against you, but we've got different rules. How do we play?
Right. And so when in 1869, when Princeton and Rutgers meet, they spend a lot of time before their game, which is considered the first official intercollegiate football game, arguing over which ball to use, a small ball or a large ball, and whose rules to use. And they end up using Rutgers' rules, and Rutgers wins. The following week, the two teams go to Princeton and play. And they play under Princeton's rules with Princeton's ball, and Princeton wins. So you have a number of meetings occurring during the 1870s, but it's not until 1882 with Walter Camp, who has played football at Yale, providing some really innovative insight into the game. And it's from him that we really get the development of the line of scrimmage. That's what separates American football visually from other sports. You see that line of scrimmage, you don't have the scrum. The development of the quarterback, because if you're going to have a line of scrimmage, you have to have someone who will receive the ball. 11 men to a side. Up until then, you've got college teams with 25 guys on a side.
Holy smokes.
And it's a pretty unwieldy game.
Yeah.
And so one of the things Walter Camp does is he downsizes. And so there are other men, of course, who are contributing. But Walter Camp is even recognized in his lifetime as the father of American football. So in the 1880s, you get a game that we would recognize as football. And the rules become so established by the 1890s, most American high schools are now fielding football teams because there's a standard uniform set of rules.
So it took off pretty fast then. No more sort of essentially what was rugby at McGill or Harvard. It was hand and foot. Now you've got it even in American high schools, and you're coming into the 20th century. Talk about rough. I mean, it was just rugged as can be. If I read you right, was it 1909? They had maybe 24 players who died on the field of football play?
Right. That's what was reported. And in the years leading up to that, it was not uncommon to have close to that figure of fatalities. Most of them tended to be on high school fields rather than college fields. But nonetheless, that was the case. The players aren't wearing much in the way of protection. In the 1880s and 1890s, a lot of them are actually growing their hair long as if this is going to provide some protection. But that's what they did. They were called chrysanthemum-haired players.
Because they had a big poof of hair on top of
this big mop of hair, yeah, which they thought would be helpful. So it's not until really the end of the 19th century that you see players starting to wear rubber nose guards. Some of them are putting padding in their pants. And the helmets that we start to see, like the aviator-style leather helmets.
The leatherhead. Mm-hmm.
Those are coming in around 1909. Mm-hmm.
That 24 dead, do you really give that any credence, or is that just some kind of newspaper, you know, hype of the time?
Well, the newspapers do provide the names and cities of these fatalities of the players who were killed. And as I say, most of them were youngsters. But every now and then there would be college players. And this was something of a surprise, actually, to people, because it was thought that college players were better trained and were in better condition. And that's one of the reasons why you have the crisis that emerges in the early 20th century is when college players are dying on the field. That something has to be done. And so this is when you have the development of the NCAA to implement some rules and to find a way to make a safer game while keeping the game still a hardy game. There was a lot of concern when they made some of these rules changes in 1905 that they would sissify the game, that it would become very unmanly. And that was a huge concern. And we even hear about that today, players talking about, well, if you change the rules, it's not football anymore. They were concerned about this over 100 years ago as well, that if you change the game to make it safer, it's not really football.
Meaning that violence, the rough and tough, was supposed to be here. That was elemental in some way to the game.
That's right. Absolutely. It is a game of blocking and tackling. Those are the absolute essential elements. And if you're going to have that, you're going to have violence. It's choreographed violence.
Choreographed violence. And it was rough. We talk about exploitation of college players today. What happens to academic standards? Who plays where and all the rest? You take us back to a time when, I mean, it was just mercenary as can be college play.
Absolutely. Players were being paid under the table. You did have professional players back then. And this is in an age that really admires the amateur ideal.
Wait, professional or college? Or was it one and the same?
Well, it's interesting. It depended on the school, and it depended to some degree on the players. But the major powers, which would be the Ivy League schools, the major powers in the 1880s, 1890s, they are paying some of their players. Other athletes are called tramp athletes. That is, that they will appear on the field for one team 1 week, and the next week they'll go to another team that needs a good player. And so what you have here then is a situation in which players are already being recruited. They're already being promised a pass on the college entrance exams if they will play football. A lot of the things that we have been worrying about for the last century about the nature of college sports, those are already going on at the end of the 19th century.
And some of those tramp athletes or otherwise playing college football until they were in their 30s, just going on and on.
That's right. They would. And they would also be playing on club teams. They would be, which was supposed to be an amateur team. You know, each town would have its own club team, a YMCA team, and they would be paid for that as well. So, yes, there's always been kind of an underside to the game. And the concerns that we have about academics, the concerns that we have about how much time players are putting into the sport and how much time the rest of the student body is putting into the sport. You already had college presidents complaining that football was overwhelming the student body at the time. So in some ways, nothing has changed.
It'll be big with Bruno Mars at halftime this weekend. There was a time when there was no halftime. I want to ask you about that because, of course, Pepsi is out with this ad where they're sort of giving this the Pepsi version of how halftime was created. I guess it's a joke, but they, you know, the car shows up, old-timey car, and they've got Pepsi, and they stop the game, and they drink a little Pepsi. Here's some from that ad.
Can we get a little help?
Focus, fellas.
We've got Pepsi.
What if we just take like 15 minutes?
Halfway through the game?
They got Pepsi.
So what do we call that?
Halftime.
I like that.
I like halftime. Okay, Pepsi's version of the origin of halftime. Where did it come from, Susan?
Pepsi's version is, looks to me, at least from looking at the ad, about 40 years too late, actually. That looks to be maybe a game that was set around the 1920s.
Yes.
We know in the 1880s they were having halftime, and they weren't drinking Pepsi, but what they were doing was sucking on lemon slices. And halftime could be 15 to 20 minutes. Players were just lounging around on the field. And one of the things that happened is you have at this time the development of the college band, which is coming out of the military tradition of military training on college campuses. So while that was going on, the band would consider this an opportunity to play. And so then coaches began realizing, well, we've also got this time while they're all sitting around sucking on lemons and listening to music to make some adjustments to what we see out on the field.
Substitutions, which they hadn't had before. They'd have an hour-long play, just the same crew in there the whole time.
Playing offense and defense. That was the thing that was so amazing. And so it's not until the early 20th century that they start to divide the game into 15-minute quarters with the purpose of allowing you to take out some exhausted player because the NCAA discovers that some of the deaths that are occurring is a result of exhaustion and that players who are out there playing both offense and defense the entire time are much more susceptible and vulnerable to injury.
I would guess so. Anne in Savannah, Georgia is calling. Anne, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My grandfather was Langdon Lee. He, All-American football player, class of 1895, Princeton.
Did you say 1895? That's amazing. Family pride, Langdon Lee. What do you know of him, man?
Well, hang on. I have a fantastic story.
Okay.
When I was growing up, I knew this then young guy who was, he said, weighed 100 pounds, named Nettie Poe. Nephew of the great Poe from Baltimore. And Nettie played, yes, Edgar Allan. He played with my grandfather, who was a tackle. And this is Nettie telling me, Nettie, I'm maybe 16, Nettie's in his 90s. And he said, in those days, you couldn't have a forward pass. So football could never go ahead of the line of scrimmage unless it was being held.
Yes.
So whether it's true or not, Nettie said, they would put the football in his arms and throw him.
little Nettie Poe, nephew of Edgar Allan Poe. It's all a little hard to picture here, but it's a great tale. Susan, what do you make of Anne's great tale out of Savannah?
Oh, she's absolutely right. In fact, we have a picture in the book of Columbia University throwing a player over the line of scrimmage.
You're kidding me.
No, I am not. Absolutely happened. There were a couple of plays that they had in which, for example, if it was very wet out, your quarterback would come running up the backside of his lineman up to the shoulders and from there launch himself over.
Note to Seahawks.
Right. And in other instances, they actually outfitted the quarterback with large belt loops on his pants, and his lineman would pick him up and hurl him over for the required yardage. So your caller is absolutely right. They did have plays like this.
Courtesy of the granddaughter of All-American Langdon Lee and the nephew of Edgar Allan Poe. Thank you, Nettie Poe. We have flying football players. The NFL comes on the scene at some point here. It's dancing with college, because college was already pretty big. And some colleges learned very early on they could make huge names for themselves, maybe foremost Notre Dame.
Absolutely. The colleges are ruling football. And in the early 20th century in Ohio, that's really where you have the birth of professional football. You've got a lot of amateur clubs, supposedly amateur clubs, with players. And in Ohio, they have what's called the Ohio League. This is supposed to be an amateur league, but by 1905, it's not. Players are being openly paid. And this is really kind of the birthplace then of the NFL. And in 1920, the NFL, in fact, is born there. And for the first number of years, the NFL is really kind of the younger brother, obviously, to college football. And it wasn't a reputable sport entirely either.
Sort of a joke, the professional wing of things here.
Absolutely. And they weren't playing in the major cities as they do nowadays. They were playing kind of in second-tier, smaller cities. And they obviously didn't have the traditions that college had. And so it's not until Red Grange in 1925, who is the star for the University of Illinois, agrees to sign with the Chicago Bears. And he brings some credibility to the NFL. And it makes people look at the league with, give it a second look that, hey, maybe there is something to this.
What was the argument for a professional league at that point? There was so much college football going on. How did the early, national professional league sell itself?
Well, that was one of their issues. How do you sell yourself? For one thing, you lower your ticket prices. And so it was cheaper to go to an NFL game than it was to go to a college game. One of the things that they tried to emphasize, though, the NFL in the early years, was that these were players who had played in college and were already trained. And so you would be seeing an older, more mature player who was more gifted than the college player. That was something that they were trying to push. But it was never conceived of as a tremendous business opportunity. It was really, owners of these teams were really just in it to have a good time for the most part. A lot of them were in the car business or they were in other businesses, and they owned these professional teams sort of as a sideline. So it's really not until after World War II that you start to see a change in the NFL in which it does become more of a business and it becomes much more reputable.
Let me go to Brian in Lexington, Kentucky. Brian, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well. What do you know?
Well, I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, and a little-known fact is that the first professional game was played there in Triangle Park. Can you guys talk about that a little bit?
What year would you reckon that might have been, Brian?
I want to say about 1901, but I could be off. She might know better than I would.
Yeah, Susan, does that fit into your telling?
It does, in that, yes, Ohio has a number of this Ohio League has teams all over the state, and as I said, it's becoming a little more acceptable to pay your players, whether or not it's open or not. Everybody knows that this is kind of going on. And it's not until 1905, though, when you have probably two of the biggest teams, the Canton Bulldogs, which Jim Thorpe later played for, and the Massillon team is playing. And the concern there is that the game is rigged. There are a lot of charges that it's a rigged game and that everyone is going to not only be paid to play, but they're going to make some money off it afterwards. So this is one of the issues that the NFL has to combat early on.
We're talking about 400 years of American football with Susan Rayburn. Her terrific new book, lots of pictures, and a great tale to tell is Football Nation, 400 Years of America's Game. Talk about history. Here's Justin Timberlake, Janet Jackson, 2004. We remember. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Let me rock your body. Come on and dance with me. You don't have to.
this song.
He drops straight back, has some time, now scrambles away from one hit. Looks, uncorks a deep one for the end zone. Phelan is down there.
Oh, he got it!
Did he get it?
He got it!
Touchdown! 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 Touchdown!
November 1984, big moment in American football history. Boston College, University of Miami. Seconds left, VC trailing 45-41. Quarterback Doug Flutie went for the win with a Hail Mary to wide receiver Greg Phelan. So famous, it was given a name, Hail Flutie. We're talking this hour about 400 years of American football from the beaches of Jamestown to Super Bowl 48 this Sunday with Susan Rayburn, author of the big new book, Football Nation, 400 Years of America's Game. We'll talk before the show's out about Super Bowl 48 coming up on Sunday. Susan Rayburn joins us from Washington today. We've got a lot more history to look at. Pete in Lebanon, Tennessee. Pete, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Georgia Tech versus Cumberland University, 222-0. Georgia Tech won.
Say it's not so. In what year?
This is back in the early 1900s.
How is that possible?
The Guinness World Record is the most lopsided.
What, was there even a second team on the field, Susan?
They actually went into the bleachers and took students and went into the dorms and got students out of the dorm to finish the game.
Sounds like they needed the National Guard. Susan, does a score like that make sense to you in the football history?
Absolutely, that did happen. Part of the reason why it happened was that poor old Cumberland, who was the victim that day, was dropping football. And in order to not be in breach of contract and lose $3,000, they had to play. And so they did, as your caller suggests, they were pulling out everyone that they could, actually, to form a team. And the coach of Georgia Tech at the time was John Heisman, who made the comment at halftime when they were up by more than 100 points. He warned his team, don't let up, because you don't know. Cumberland might have something up their sleeve.
Don't let up, boys. Oh, boy, it never ends. Broadcasting, a huge factor in the history of American football. Here's a little bit. This is the afternoon of a very special, particular day. This was December 7th, 1941, Pearl Harbor Day. The New York Giants were playing the Brooklyn Dodgers, an NFL team back then at the Polo Grounds in New York. WOR New York Radio broadcast the game.
It's a long one down to around the 3-yard line. Ward Cuff takes it, cutting up to his left. He's over the 10. Nice block there by Lehman. Cuff's still going. He's up to the 25. And now he's hit and hit hard about the 27-yard line.
Moments later, that broadcast was interrupted by the news that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor. That history is why we have that recording still around today. Susan Rayburn, the onslaught of broadcasting, how did it begin? What did it do with and for the game?
Well, what's interesting about it is that as radio develops in the 1920s, baseball is really not too enthusiastic about it. You know, they've got games being played almost every day during the season, 154 games at the time. And they're concerned that if people are listening to games on the radio, they won't come to the stadium. Football takes a totally different approach. Most teams are only going to be playing about 10 games a season. And they feel like anything we can do to promote the game, let's have it happen. Let's let radio come into the stadiums. And so some teams arrange for exclusive contracts with radio producers. But what makes Notre Dame unusual is that they allow anyone and everyone to come up into their fledgling press booth and broadcast. And what this does, for the Irish at least, is it puts their name and the names of their players out all across the country in the 1920s. And so without having exclusive contracts, everyone can come in and broadcast from South Bend.
And they learned in a hurry that this could make a school's name. It did for Notre Dame.
It sure did. It was very helpful. You had what became called the Subway alumni. And not only do you have the Catholic population that's following Notre Dame, but people who are all around the country who have begun listening to those games and hearing those names, they tend to follow that team then. And so it is. It's very helpful for Notre Dame. And the Associated Press reports in the late 1920s that the attendance at college football games pretty much doubles from 12 million to about 24 million by the end of the 1920s. And they attribute a lot of that, not all of it, but a lot of that, to the power of radio.
You write about 7-day train rides to play away games.
Right. It was, you know. Well, and speaking of Notre Dame again, coming to play the Rose Bowl in 1925, one of the things that Newt Rockne told the press was that his men were growing feeble from sitting on the train the whole way, and he was concerned that they probably weren't even going to win and they'd be lucky if they scored 3 points.
Race football didn't have a Jackie Robinson.
No, it did not.
So how did it happen? The integration.
Well, it's interesting that baseball had this moment that's just kind of emblazoned in our national memory of, you know, 1947, Jackie Robinson coming out for the Dodgers. Everybody knew that when that was going to happen. Everybody sort of braced themselves for it. But with football, what you see in the Northeast, in many of those colleges, there are black players who are already playing in the 1880s and 1890s. There aren't many, but they're there. And some schools will refuse to play a team that has a black player and ask that player be benched. But all in all, the decision is being made by individual schools, whether or not they want to integrate. It's not being made by a league. It's not being made by an owner. And so there's a difference with that. And so what you have happen then is, as the 20th century progresses, more and more teams in the North and the Midwest are integrating. Teams in the South are not. And this really starts to come to a head in the mid-20th century when you have bowl games that are in the South, the Cotton Bowl and the Sugar Bowl. And they either won't invite black teams that have black players, or there is an issue with the white schools that don't want to play a team like that. So integration moves in fits and starts in football. It kind of is a very organic movement.
TV just blows the lid off. There's so much of your history we're not going to get to in this hour, but it becomes the mega sport at that point. And now we're in the age, Susan, of concern again about the violence, the concussions, the brain injuries, and changing rules around that. Do you see football still evolving, still morphing? Will it become yet something else?
I think it very well could be. I think it very well could be. And that will ultimately be up to, I think, the kids who are playing now. Are their parents letting them play as children, or are they letting them play flag football and tag football, but asking that they not play tackle? And as those kids get older, they're going to be the ones who will make the decision as to whether or not they want to sacrifice themselves, as it were, in some cases, or not. And so we're going to see it in the next generation, I think.
You really had fun with this book. Hirohito, we didn't get to him. What's the Hirohito football story? Emperor of Japan during the war.
He became very interested in football when he met President Gerald Ford, who used to play for the University of Michigan. He really wanted to see what this American football thing was all about. So when he arrives in the U.S., there is some concern about his safety. And he does get to see a game, but they have him behind a bulletproof glass booth there to protect him, because there's a lot of concern that you don't know how those American fans will be.
Well, football is not exactly Zen, but there was Emperor Hirohito at the game. Lots of people, many millions, will be there on Sunday. Susan Rayburn, you tell a terrific story in this book with terrific visuals as well. The book is Football Nation: 400 Years of America's Game. Susan, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure to be here.
Behind us right here, Michael Jackson, 1993 Super Bowl halftime rendition of Black or White. In a moment, a look ahead at Super Bowl 48. This is On Point. Every year, millions of Americans tune into football's epic Sunday, Super Bowl Sunday. It's beer and buddies, trash talk, much anticipated commercial breaks. This year, Super Bowl 48. The Seattle Seahawks, the Denver Broncos face off in New Jersey. It'll be cold, but Bruno Mars will be there to warm everything up at halftime. There's a lot on the line, always is, and a lot of money, too. So what to expect? Joining us now from Fairfield, Connecticut, with a prelude to the big game, Armin Katayan, correspondent for CBS News and Showtime's 60 Minutes Sports, co-author with Jeff Benedict of The System, The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. He'll be covering this year's Super Bowl 48 at the MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. Armin Katayan, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Oh, nice to be back, Tom.
As Super Bowls go, how are you anticipating this one? Especially good big game coming, something else? What's the flavor?
Well, the flavor right now is the city is really starting to come alive. I was earlier in the week in New York. It was a little dead, and the sense was that, you know, the natives had gotten out of town in anticipation of the game. But I was downtown last night in the meatpacking district at an event, and you know, the city is really coming to life, and the Super Bowl Boulevard from, you know, the sort of the Herald Square area up to Times Square was just absolutely jammed with people. So tonight, I think exponentially with more fans arriving on the Friday before the game, you know, it's turning out to be a showcase for the city, both New York and New Jersey. And, you know, the weather's cooperating, which is the big deal.
Remind us why the game of these two teams is in New Jersey this year.
Well, it's in New Jersey because, you know, New Jersey and New York put together a, you know, a collaborative bid to host the city. But the real reason is that the Jets and the Giants built a billion-dollar stadium out in the Meadowlands, and the league's history is that when you build a new ballpark, they did it in Jacksonville, and they've done it in other sites as well, Indianapolis, you build us a mega palace, and one of the rewards is we'll place a Super Bowl in your backyard.
So here it comes, Peyton Manning, Russell Wilson as quarterbacks, two quite different teams. What about the matchup, Broncos, Seahawks?
Well, it's a great matchup. I mean, you have the number one offense in the NFL versus the number one defense in the NFL. You have a megastar in Peyton Manning, and I was privileged, I would say, to cover Peyton since he came into the league in 1998, so 16 years. And he is an absolute, you know, one in a generation and really almost one in a lifetime kind of an athlete, a guy who really doesn't want to be the best quarterback of his generation. He wants to be and has worked to be the best quarterback in the history of the league. And on the other side, I've had the pleasure of meeting Russell Wilson, who's very young, 21, 22 years old, but in many ways represents the prototype of the quarterbacks that are now really have changed the game in the league. And it's interesting, Tom, that if you go back into the history, and I was listening to Susan, if you go back into the history of the league, the quarterback that broke the color line in the NFL was Marlon Briscoe with the Denver Broncos in the mid-1960s.
Yes.
Turns out that Marlon Briscoe was really the forerunner of what you see now in Colin Kaepernick and in Russell Wilson and the Cam Newtons, the very mobile running quarterbacks that have an ability to make plays with both their arm and their feet. So in an odd way, the league has kind of come around to its history here with these quarterbacks, and certainly now no longer judged by the color of their skin, but just the ability to produce on the football field.
Seattle's defense, so incredibly strong.
Yeah.
How does it meet that Peyton Manning offense of the Broncos?
Well, it's going to be interesting because a lot of teams on defense try to out-scheme the Broncos, and it's very, very difficult to do that with Peyton because he and Tom Brady are probably the two brightest minds, with Drew Brees in that category as well. Almost computer-like capabilities to sense out what the defense is going to do and then switch and maybe switch once more to a different play. Seattle is a very different kind of defense. They're very, very physical up front, and they're very physical in the secondary. So they're going to match up virtually man-to-man, and they're going to basically force Peyton and his wide receivers to beat them on an individual basis and not on a schematic basis, which should make for just an absolutely great kind of game because you know, the Broncos have some very good wide receivers, certainly in Wes Welker and others, that can move around on the field. But, you know, this Legion of Boom, which is the name that the Seattle secondary has given themselves. And
Legion of Boom. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great name. And, you know, Richard Sherman is a household name now. And the guy you really want to watch for is their safety is Earl Thomas, who's an absolutely phenomenal football player and has the same kind of instinctual qualities that you're looking for from a safety and matches up, I think, very, very well with Peyton Manning.
What about the psychology of this game? You mentioned Richard Sherman. Of course, he had his infamous big trash talk outburst that got so much attention. Is that a psychological factor here?
No, I think what's the psychological factor, I think, is going to be just the game itself. It's a very different kind of a game, you know, because of a couple of things. One, all the pressure that's associated with a game like this. But two, these games are different structurally. The halftime is, you know, a half
long.
Hour long.
Mm-hmm.
And these teams are used to a certain routine before a game. And I remember when I've had the pleasure of doing two Super Bowls, and one of them was with Bill Belichick and the Patriots when they beat the Carolina Panthers. And mm-hmm. Bill was telling us that the hardest thing was to kind of keep the team focused. Because the lead up to the game, you go out on the field and you go back into the locker room, and you have to wait longer because there's so much more pregame stuff. And then you kind of, the halftime is almost twice as long because of the halftime entertainment. So the rhythms of the game are different, and that does affect the game and also the crowd, because the crowd is not a home crowd in any way, shape, or form. It's going to be a very corporate crowd, and it's almost a silence to the stadium, certainly compared to what Seattle has heard out in the Pacific Northwest.
Right.
So I think some of those things could become factors in a game, subtle factors in a game.
What are the wise guys saying? I mean, is there a consensus on where this is likely to go among sports reporters, among, I don't know, the bookies? What's the outlook?
No, the line has moved around. I think the smart money likes the Seahawks in a game like this because of their defense. But, you know, there's a lot of sentiment. And, you know, the average fan bets with their heart, not with their head. And a lot of money has moved early on into the Broncos because of Peyton and how he played in the AFC Championship game against the Patriots. So I'm sort of in the mind of my heart is with the Broncos, my head is with the Seahawks.
And what about just covering the Super Bowl? Do you enjoy it, Armin, or do you like a regular game sort of in the middle of the season better?
Well, as I said, doing two of them, when you are part of the broadcast network, as I was with CBS Sports, there's really no better event in the world to cover because you have complete access. You know, being a sideline reporter for those games, it was like an all-access pass to not only all the events that you wanted to go to, but the press conferences and the behind-the-scenes stuff with the production meetings. I spent some time at what is known as Radio Row at the Sheraton Hotel on Thursday promoting a story I'm doing for 60 Minutes on sports on Eddie George. And it's just nuts over there. I mean, it's 400 sports talk radio stations kind of crammed into a ballroom surrounded by the NFL network. And guys like, you know, Dick Vermeil, a great coach who's out talking about the winery that he has out in California. So everybody's kind of got, a guy gave me some of the people I know gave me a candy bar called Brain Bar for dealing with the concussion issues. So there's almost, you know, there's just it's a crazy melange of people who are connected to the sport or on the periphery, but also, you know, where they're hawking products.
Everybody's there, everything going on at Super Bowl time. Armin Katayan with CBS News and Showtime 60 Minute Sports. Always great to talk with you, Armin.
You too, Tom. Thank you.
Here's Halo, Beyonce, last year, Super Bowl 47, 48. Coming up, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank y'all so much. Thank you for this moment. God bless y'all.